This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody, to another exciting episode of Crimes and Consequences. I'm Talia, and I'm sitting here with my beautiful host, Tanya.
Hi, everyone.
I searched high and low for an amazing episode, and I think I found a really good one.
Oh, good.
Before I start, I'd like to ask everybody to hit the subscribe/follow button if you haven't done so already on whatever app you're listening to. And with that, I'm going to start.
Sounds good.
In 1993, 44-year-old Bill Richards and his wife, Pam, they owned 5 acres of remote property in the Mojave Desert. This is in San Bernardino County, California. They purchased the land 8 years prior with the intent on building their own compound, an oasis of sorts in the high desert. They had owned their own home in Riverside, California, which was a little over an hour away, but they sold it a year earlier and they moved onto their property. To get to the property, you had to travel down Interstate 15, exit onto a state road, and then turn down a dusty road that led to oblivion, in my opinion.
Middle of nowhere.
Yes. Access to the property was made more difficult because they had a steep gravel driveway, one of those dusty dirt driveways. Nestled in the small box canyon was their Nissan Sunraider RV. Bill and Pam lived in that while they were constructing their dream compound in their spare time. So I'm going to describe their living arrangements. In front of the RV were some steps, and they led to a porch that the couple had built themselves that allowed them to sit outside and enjoy the desert air. The porch didn't take up the whole side of the RV camper. It was just a partial porch, in essence. Leading away from the porch steps were stepping stones that took you to the trailer's door. Roughly 25 feet away from the trailer, they built the shed that had a metal fence. The Sunraider RV was powered by large marine batteries that were attached to the camper that led away to a gas-powered generator kept inside the fenced shed. So you have this shed. Inside it, there's this generator, and there's also furniture and personal belongings that couldn't fit in the RV from when they lived in Riverside. The couple kept 3 large dogs on their property to scare away any wayward trespassers. Pam and Bill also owned guns, and Pamela knew how to use them in case she ever needed to protect herself. Although they lived in a remote area, the camper had a landline, and there was also other like-minded neighbors with a need for privacy and seclusion that weren't too far away from them. The couple was very wary of what they considered their trashy neighbors just down the road. Previously, someone from a neighboring RV had stolen water from their shed, and others had been caught trespassing on the Richards property. In fact, the adult son living with some campers down the road had even been caught looking at Pam through his telescope.
Are you kidding me?
No, of course I'm not kidding you.
What a perv. He's a
creeper. Bill worked the swing shift as a mechanical engineer at a manufacturing facility in Corona, California. It's a very unfortunate name for the city and the beer in this day and age.
True.
40-year-old Pam worked as a waitress at the Olive Garden, which was located in the nearby town of Hesperia. Now, on the morning of August 10th, Bill and Pam took a morning walk together. They held hands as they strolled past their neighbors.
Good morning.
Hey. Bill left for work in the early afternoon, and he didn't clock out until around 11:03 p.m. that night. Being that the Richards RV didn't have a refrigerator.
They didn't have a fridge?
No, they did not. He filled a cooler with ice from a machine at the plant before driving home. So he leaves at 11:03. He fills up his cooler with some ice and he heads home. He usually didn't get home until around midnight, and Pam would stay up and wait for him. They had this routine of watching Married with Children together after he arrived home.
Have you ever watched it? No, I mean like now.
No.
Ugh, it would never air today.
It shouldn't have aired back when it did. Anyway, when Bill got back that night, they didn't watch Married with Children. That evening, as he approached the camper, the first thing Bill noticed was how dark it was there. There wasn't a single light on. He couldn't imagine Pam being comfortable out there in the desert alone in the pitch black. Pulling up the steep incline, he parked his Ford pickup truck and grabbed a flashlight from his glove box. He was greeted by his dogs, who ran free outside most of the time. Bill walked towards the shed because he was going to start the generator. And as he was walking there, he's yelling out Pam's name. But she didn't answer. Using the flashlight to guide him, he restarted the generator. And then he started walking back towards the camper. But as he was walking, he tripped over something. Looking down, he saw Pam, his wife of 21 years, laying on the ground next to the porch steps, covered with blood. Bill ran into the RV to call the police, but before he got a chance, the phone rang. When Bill answered the call, he heard the familiar voice of Eugene Price, a helicopter pilot who also happened to be Pam's lover. This wasn't a secret to Bill. He too had women on the sly, and the couple considered themselves to be in an open relationship.
Got it.
Each other's indiscretions were considered nothing more than recreational sex. So the time is exactly 11:55 p.m. Eugene Price asked Bill if he could speak with Pam. Agitated and upset, Bill told him that Pam seemed to have fallen and bashed her head on either a large cement block or some nearby rocks. Her eye was hanging out of its socket.
What?
That's exactly what Eugene said. Eugene said, okay, hang up and call 911. And Bill's like, yeah.
Yeah, no shit, Sherlock.
I was just going to do that.
Yeah, can you get off the phone so I can do that?
Bill first dialed 911 at 11:58 p.m. He reported he needed emergency assistance because he had just come home from work and discovered that his wife was dead. The operator assured him someone would be dispatched immediately. 8 minutes after his first call, he placed a second call to 911. In the second call, he asked how much longer is it going to be before the responders arrive, explaining that he now believes his wife was murdered. He said, quote, things don't look right here at all. There's something. Something's been moved. He specifically requested that someone with experience investigating a crime scene be sent to his house. The operator advised Bill to stay put and not touch anything. But it was too late because Bill had already rolled Pam over from her stomach onto her back when he first found her. Plus, you know, he's touched the phone, he's touched the door, he's touched the shed, he's touched the generator, etc. Minutes tick by as Bill waits for the police and the paramedics to arrive. As he's sitting in his camper, he begins noticing more evidence of a violent struggle. After waiting patiently for 35 minutes, Bill calls 911 for the third time.
What the hell? Thank God she's like not hanging to life.
Right?
Waiting for the ambulance.
He yelled to the operator, and this is a quote, where the fuck are you people? My wife's been murdered.
That sounds reasonable.
Right? I can't blame him at all.
Me either.
What the fuck is going on?
Can you send someone out here?
She advised him to go sit in his pickup truck and wait for the police. 40 minutes after placing his first 911 call, Bill spotted the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Deputy, Mark Norris, driving down the dusty road. There were no flashing lights. There was no ambulance following. Just one lone deputy who seemed to be confused as to where he was even going. The sky was overcast and the property, as I said, was really dark because there's no street lights. So Bill flashed his truck lights. After pulling up the steep incline, Deputy Norris parked his patrol car and he used his headlights and a flashlight to illuminate the scene. Bill led the officer to Pam's half-naked body near the porch steps. As they approached, the couple's three dogs started acting really aggressively to Deputy Norris. They were barking and growling at him, as if they were protecting Pam's body. Pieces of Pam's skull laid scattered around her, and it appeared that the skull itself had been gouged out by some kind of blunt object.
What the hell?
And that's what Deputy Norris said.
Oh my God.
No, I don't really know what he said, but probably. It was clear there was no accident. The petite 5'2", 126-pound woman had been viciously assaulted and murdered. Earlier, I told you one of her eyes was hanging loose. An ear of hers was partially ripped off. Deputy Norris placed his hand on her body, and she was neither warm nor cold to the touch, in his opinion. Her arm was pliable, which meant rigor mortis hadn't set in yet. But rigor mortis is the third stage of death, and that doesn't occur on average until about 4 hours after death. Her blood was still wet, bright, and puddled. It hadn't coagulated or soaked into the sandy, dry soil yet. Based on his prior experiences as a trained emergency medical technician and a first responder firefighter, Officer Norris believed that she had died very recently. But Bill openly disagreed with that opinion. To him, Pamela fell, quote, stone cold dead. In addition, the battery in the camper had run out before he got home. They always fired up the generator well before the battery would die, so he knew that some time had gone by. Deputy Norris became suspicious of Bill, later admitting that before he even arrived on the scene, he assumed that Bill was responsible for his wife's death. As the two men were conversing, Officer Norris began surreptitiously recording their conversation. During this recording, Bill explained in detail how he came home, he found Pam, she's lying face down on the dirt with her head against a large cement block. When he rolled her over to check on her, his fingers slipped into a hole in her head.
Oh my God.
He repeatedly said things like, it ain't right here, something's not right. And he pointed to Pam's jeans, which were covered with blood on the ground by the shed, not on Pam. He explained that Pam had to squeeze into those particularly tight jeans because she'd gained weight recently. And he said, quote, they would not have come off her easily. It's not funny, but it's damn funny.
Do you remember wearing skin tight jeans? You have to lay on your back.
Oh, yeah.
Struggling. It's like a second skin.
Yes. The two men made their way inside the RV. Pam's underwear that she'd put on in the morning were found laying on the floor of the camper. The vacuum, which was normally in the shed, was also inside the camper. Now, Bill theorized that she had intended to start the generator so she could vacuum the floor, and she didn't want the power to go out because the vacuum takes up a lot of energy. And she must have been attacked shortly after entering the shed. There was smeared blood on the telephone, and propped up at the end of the couch were two pillows covered with blood, dirt, and small pebbles. The property owned by Bill and Pam was a box canyon with high hills on the east and west side of it. Blood was located by Bill on rocks up against the hill. There was also a blood-stained stepping stone that appeared to have been thrown over the side of the canyon slope, so it was kind of on the edge. It didn't fall to the other side. Bill started cursing his dogs for not protecting his wife. And remember, this is all recorded. Debbie Norris described Bill's demeanor as very calm, cool, and collected, but occasionally he would fall to his knees crying, after which he'd get back up and then continue talking. To the deputy, it seemed as if Bill's speaking was rehearsed and scripted. After Bill and Officer Norris searched the trailer and all the property thoroughly, there was nothing to indicate a robbery. Nothing was stolen. Deputy Norris ordered Bill to stay away from the crime scene while he waited for the homicide team to arrive, because he called them. Somebody called them. I don't know. Apparently, at some point, they got the memo. The medical examiner was never even called.
Seriously.
Now, are you ready for this? Almost 3 hours later.
3 hours.
At 3:15 a.m., homicide detectives arrived to the property. But, Tanya, because of the darkness, they decided it would be better to wait until dawn to process the crime scene.
Are you shitting me?
Nope, I'm not shitting you. Before they left, though, they tried to help Bill secure his dogs up so they wouldn't trample all over Pam's body evidence. However, the dogs managed to evade them, so they left anyway.
Oh my God, they're like, see you in the morning.
They put a blanket over her body and left her body on the desert ground.
Oh my God. I can't believe that.
Is that messed up?
Totally. It's dark. We're not going to investigate for a few more hours. We're just going to leave her body here. What the hell?
With dogs running around, and not to mention all the other desert animals. At roughly 6 a.m., Detective Norman Parent, criminologist Dan Greganis, and a forensic specialist arrived at the Richards property to begin processing the crime scene. By then, the dogs had partially buried Pam's head in the dirt, and their paw prints were everywhere, contaminating the crime scene. So I'm going to describe the crime scene now. Pam's body was laying between the camper's porch steps and a table cart. On the ground beside her was a tremendous amount of blood. Because Bill had flipped her over, she was now laying on her back, but she had died on her stomach. Her right arm had been rested above her head on top of this heavy metal grate fencing that lay flattened on the dirt. The only items of clothing on her was her tank top, which had numerous blood stains and blood splatter, and her socks. Pam's head was completely crushed, destroying her facial features and causing her brain matter to be exposed. Her head touched part of a large chunk of cement. And on that large chunk of cement were some of her hairs and brain matter. Based on the destruction of Pam's cranium, criminalist Greganis speculated that the cement had been dropped on her head multiple times as she lay on the ground.
Oh my God.
As I mentioned earlier, a stepping stone with blood and brain matter was also most likely dropped on Pam's head, and that had been tossed towards the edge of the Box Canyon slope. Now, oddly, Pam's bare legs had no blood on them, but her pants did. Her jeans were absolutely covered with blood. The porch, the table cart, stepping stones leading from the porch to the camper door, and the camper's entryway all had blood splatter on it. Not smears, not drops, splatter. Those could only come from an act of assault. Roughly 8 yards from Pam's body, near the shed where the generator was, investigators found blood stains on the ground, and there was a nearby gas can that also had blood on it. There was a fist-sized bloody rock along with one of Pam's shoes. Next to the bloody rock, detectives found a broken piece of Pam's fingernail. Now, this is away from the camper. The fencing surrounding the shed had blood splatter on it, too. Inside the shed, in front of the generator, was a spilled can of oil and an empty oil bottle. Pam's other shoe and those bloody tight jeans were there. Based on the crime scene evidence, Detective Parent speculated that Pam was indeed attacked inside the shed while she was starting up the generator. She was first hit with a fist-sized rock, and then the attack progressed. The crime scene was examined for tire tracks and footprints, but the only tire tracks they were able to decipher were from Bill's pickup truck, Pam's Suzuki, and their patrol cars. The property soil, as you can imagine, is really dry and really hard-packed, so it's not really conductive of retaining footprints. And let's not forget the dogs that were free to roam around. As a result, they only found 4 shoe prints in the entire property. 3 were from Pam, and 1 was consistent with Bill's shoe. The shoes were very worn with little tread. And all the property, that's all they found. Pam's Suzuki Samurai was parked in front of the camper in its usual place. On the passenger seat was her purse and wallet, exactly where she'd left it. When police opened the purse, they found something that really piqued their interest. There was a folded up letter written, signed, and dated a month prior by Bill that proposed a division of the couple's assets and personal property. In the true crime world, divorce is a huge motive for murder. It's like number one.
Right.
Roughly 12 hours after Bill made his first call to 911, Pam's body was removed from the scene and taken to the medical examiner's office. Dr. Frank Sheridan, he was the chief medical examiner of San Bernardino County. He performed the autopsy on Pam. He discovered that Pam hadn't just been beaten with cement blocks, the fist-sized rock, and a stepping stone, but she'd also been strangled. Her killer had first attacked her with a ligature of some sort. When that didn't work, he wrapped his hands around her neck. But the second strangulation attempt brought her to the brink of death, but it didn't kill her. Dr. Sheridan estimated that the manual strangulation lasted maybe 2 to 3 minutes at the most. Pam ultimately died as a result of the left side of her skull being repeatedly smashed in with a cement block and a stepping stone, crushing her brain. He reached this conclusion based on the small amount of bleeding and bruising in the area of the skull. That's what led him to believe that she was very close to death anyway. But Pam put up a fight. There was bruising across her body, broken fingernails, lacerations and abrasions on her face. Although she was found naked from the waist down, she wasn't raped.
Why does she not have pants on?
I know. Based on the significant blood splatter on her jeans and the lack of blood on her bare legs, it appeared that someone had removed her pants and underwear after her head had been crushed.
That's fucking weird.
Yeah, and then think about this. Why are her jeans by the generator and her underwear
in the house, right?
Are in the house. And then, of course, there's bloody pillows on the couch with pebbles. In this case, establishing the time of death was of the utmost importance because the police were convinced Bill was their killer. Since the medical examiner was never called out on the scene and the police didn't take Pam's body temperature, the usual means for determining the time of death couldn't be established. Dr. Sheridan decided to maybe try to establish it through the lividity of Pam's body. Lividity is the deep red-purple discoloration seen on a body after death, which is created when the heart stops beating. The blood settles down to the lowest parts of the body by way of gravity. It doesn't become fixed on the body until 6 to 10 hours later. And Pam's body had what was described as very weak lividity because she lost so much blood during the attack. In the end, Dr. Sheridan could give no opinion at all to the time of death. The Richards RV and shed were removed from the property and taken into evidence. And now the police began focusing on finding the person or persons responsible for the violent murder of Pam. Bill voluntarily came to the police station for questioning. After hours and hours of interrogation with no change in his story, he was allowed to leave. They didn't have enough evidence to arrest him. Police knocked on the camper doors of the Richards neighbors and asked them a few questions like, hey, did you see anything? Did you hear anything unusual that night? No one in the surrounding area heard anything or saw anything. not even really the dogs barking, which would be unusual considering they were very protective of Pam. Police then interviewed Pam's lover, pilot Eugene Price. On the night of the murder, Eugene received a message from Pam on his answering machine sometime between 7 and 7:30, but he was out. He'd missed her call. When he arrived home at 9:30, he listened to the message and he tried to call Pam back at the camper, but all he got was a busy signal. He continued to call her about every 5 minutes, but each time he kept getting the same thing, another busy signal. Because of past problems with the telephone service in the area, and I'm imagining it's because they're living in bumfuck Egypt, Eugene contacted the phone company to check her line, but they reported there were no problems with it. He continued making phone calls every 5 minutes until Bill answered at 11:55 p.m. Eugene provided investigators with some insight into a potential motive for Pam's murder. According to Eugene, he'd met Pam a year prior to her death after he'd been in this serious helicopter crash. I don't know exactly how they met, but their relationship started out platonic, with Pam supporting him through his rehab and turned romantic later on. I'm not sure why she's supporting him during his rehab, but whatever. Recently, Pam had confided in him that she was planning to leave Bill because he was abusive.
Uh-oh.
In one instance, Pam had been beaten so badly that an ambulance had been called to their high desert property. Pam also mentioned to Eugene that Bill had increased a life insurance policy on her.
Oh, man.
Check, yes. check. So cliche.
Right.
Pam said she thought this was unusual and it made her kind of nervous. Eugene stated that he and Pam were in love and they planned on moving in together really soon. In fact, on the day she was murdered, he'd been away from the area looking for an apartment for the two of them to share once she left Bill. But the problem with everything Eugene told the police is that there was no corroborating evidence to support his claims. There were no police reports of domestic violence, although as we know, domestic violence is grossly underreported. The insurance company had no record of Bill requesting an increase in payout on Pam's life insurance, and there was no document showing an ambulance had ever been sent out to the Richards property. Police began to interview more people, trying to solve this murder mystery. They interviewed Pam's family members, who described Bill and Pam's relationship as sometimes volatile. On the night of Pam's murder, her brother Wayne, he spoke with her around 7:15 p.m., and to him, she sounded normal. Pam complained to him that she and Bill had been arguing a lot, which was really nothing new, and Wayne offered to let her stay with him in San Diego at his house. Next, detectives spoke with Pam's sister, and she gave them quite an earful. She adamantly believed that Bill had nothing to do with her sister's murder. In fact, she told authorities that Eugene Price had been stalking Pam and that Pam was, quote, deathly afraid of this guy.
Really?
Regardless of this information, police continued to focus solely on Bill. A friend of Pam's named Arthur Quass, he came forward to police and told him that he had called the camper just before 10 p.m. on the evening of August 10th. The phone rang a few times, followed by clicks and then a dial tone. He called again, but the phone rang and this time there was no answer. I don't believe they had an answering machine. It just rang and rang and rang. Maybe the phone service in the remote area was acting up, but according to Eugene Price, when he called the phone company, they said the line was fine. Perhaps the murderer answered and hung up.
Maybe.
Maybe. I was going to say, you don't know, but I do, but I don't know. So I don't know either. There's still a lot of questions that remain unanswered. Police then spoke with Bill's coworkers, and they stated on the day of the murder, Bill showed up to work per his usual scheduled time. He showed no sign of agitation, anger, frustration, There was nothing out of the ordinary with his demeanor. But detectives were determined to prove that Bill Richards had indeed murdered his wife. Big problem they were running into was the timeline. How could Bill punch out of work at 11:03 p.m., walk to his car in the parking lot, and this is at a factory, drive 44.8 miles to his house, murder his wife, and call for 911 all within 55 minutes?
That is a good question.
That's pretty tight.
Mm-hmm.
Police wanted to test their theory out. But before I tell you the results, we're going to take a quick break. A sheriff's investigator went to the Corona manufacturing plant on the same day of the week, a Tuesday, in which Pam was murdered, and reenacted Bill's drive home. After punching the time clock at 11:03, the deputy made his way to the exact location where Bill had parked his car. It took him 3 minutes to walk there. Although the posted speed limit was 55 miles per hour for most of the route home, the investigator drove with the flow of traffic, which was roughly 75 miles per hour for most of the trip. He arrived at the camper 41 minutes later, putting him there at 11:47 p.m. Bill spoke to Eugene at 11:55 p.m. That would have given Bill 7 minutes to strangle and beat Pam before answering the phone. It's enough time, but that's pretty damn tight.
That's tight.
That is real tight. The same investigator replicated Bill's route 3 more times in 3 different weeks, each on a Tuesday. None of the other drives would have allotted Bill enough time to murder Pam. On September 3, 1993, Bill volunteered to take a polygraph test for the police. According to the examiner, he was deceptive on a few relevant questions related to Pam's death. With that, Bill was arrested and charged with first-degree murder by the San Bernardino County District Attorney.
Really, all they have is a lie detector test?
Well, that was enough. Their intuition?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'll tell you all they have. Okay, we're going to go through a trial.
Okay.
But it's not going to be boring, I promise. Bill's first trial ended with a hung jury, so he was retried. His second trial ended with a hung jury, so he was tried again. His third trial ended with a mistrial because the judge recused herself during jury selection. So, 4 years later, Bill, who's been in jail the whole time,
oh my God,
is now being tried for the fourth time for the murder of his wife. And this time, the prosecutor was dead set on winning his case. 10 days prior to the commencement of the trial, prosecutors reached out to forensic dentist, an odontologist. His name was Dr. Norman Sperber. He testified at both Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer's trials. Dr. Sperber was sent a photograph of a crescent-shaped lesion that detectives and prosecutors now believed, 4 years later, may be a bite mark on Pam's right hand. Dr. Sperber knew Bill had already been tried 3 times, and he knew the prosecutor was desperate to lock him up and throw away the key. So when he was on the stand, he testified that not only was it a human bite mark on Pam's hand, but based on the autopsy photographs, it was a match to Bill's lower jaw. Bill was the killer. Unlike the previous trials, in the fourth trial, criminalist Greganis, he was at the crime scene. He testified for the prosecution. He found blue cotton fibers this time. They were wedged deep into Pam's broken fingernails. He hadn't saw them before. These cotton fibers were indistinguishable from Bill's blue cotton shirt that he was wearing on the night of the murder. Although the criminologist said, yeah, blue cotton fibers pretty common, I'm pretty sure they're from Bill's shirt.
I'm thinking if he had the shirt on when the police showed up, it would have had to be the shirt he killed her in. So how come there's no blood on it?
There was some blood evidence put in, and I didn't want to bore everybody with it, but he had a little bit of blood on him. Not very much, but he did hold her. Remember, he cradled her.
Yeah, that's right.
but I don't want to bore everybody with it because they go on and on and on about blood spatter versus blah, blah, blah. Doesn't matter. By the time the criminalist is done, he says, Bill probably killed her. I'm paraphrasing. Bill tried to put up a defense. As part of Bill's defense, a medical examiner testified that there was some advanced coloring on several of Pam's wounds and bruises, just other ones on her body, that indicated she had been hit at least an hour prior to death, which would have put Bill still at work. However, after hearing both sides of the argument, the jury announced it was deadlock.
Again? Oh my God.
The judge said, no. You're going to go back and you're going to deliberate. So they came back the next day and they announced a guilty verdict. Bill was sentenced to 25 years to life. But that's not where this story ends, right? Of course not. 15 years later, Bill was granted an evidentiary hearing regarding newly discovered evidence in the case. Do you want to know who the star witness was at his evidentiary hearing? None other than the infamous forensic odontologist, Dr. Norman Sperber. Dr. Sperber, he goes by Skip, recanted his previous testimony. He now said that advancements in science have convinced him that the bite mark wasn't made by a human, and it might not even be a bite mark at all. It might be an impression made from the metal grate fencing that her hand was rested on.
Are you fucking kidding me?
No. He said he kind of just wanted to be a hero.
Oh my God.
Yes.
That's awful.
He did say he believes Bill did it, but not based on the bite mark evidence. But here's a real kicker. Advancements in science led to the discovery of DNA on the stepping stone that was used to crush Pam's skull. That DNA didn't match Bill, but instead revealed the profile of an unknown male, yet to be identified. In addition, DNA from a long piece of hair found under one of Pam's fingernails was examined, and this too matched the unknown male profile, not Bill.
Wow.
And then last but not least, autopsy photographs originally taken by the medical examiner were enhanced, and they showed no evidence of any blue fibers under Pam's broken nail.
Oh, damn, he lied too?
I don't know. I'm not saying that. It's all alleged. But that's pretty much what the court concluded. On June 21st, 2016, Bill walked out of the West Valley Detention Center having been granted release on his own recognizance after 25 years in prison. The prosecutor was getting ready to file paperwork for Bill's fifth trial. However, a motion, and I'm not going to bore everybody with it, but a motion regarding prosecutorial harassment was being prepared. And instead of pursuing another trial, the prosecutor dropped all charges against Bill. In June of this year, a San Bernardino County Superior Court judge declared Bill Richards factually innocent of the murder of Pamela Richards, which means he is not the person responsible for her death. So what happened to Pam?
Yes, tell me, Talia, what happened to Pam?
Well, I could make some shit up if you want, because I don't really know. I have ideas, but I don't want to get sued. I've thought about it a lot, and this is what I know. She was hit by the generator with a fist-sized rock and probably first strangled there, but it wasn't very effective. She ran from that scene, and she's running into the RV, probably makes it to the phone, gets blood on the phone, somehow gets thrown on the couch, somehow makes it back outside where her head is smashed in. The problem I have with all that is I don't know where her jeans by the generator come in and her underwear inside come in. So I don't have the answers. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so, so, so sorry.
Did they ever find out who the DNA belonged to?
No.
Did they test other people?
Those are valid questions that I could not find the answers for.
Wow. Because the prosecutor thinks Bill did it. That's probably why. Damn. That totally sucks. Thanks, Talia.
Sorry. I hate it when people don't tell me who they think did it.
I need to know.
Okay, well, I mean, there are some neighbors.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
That's my thoughts.
Yeah.
Because I can tell you that I know for a fact that police did not pursue any leads or deep lines of questioning with the neighbors at all.
I know. I wonder what the motive is.
Maybe they were stealing something and she came out there.
Maybe.
Maybe they hated her. Maybe they're psycho. Who knows?
It's true.
We'll probably never know the answer of who killed Pam Richards, and that's unfortunate. But at least Bill Richards isn't in jail anymore, prison.
Yeah, after 25 years.
That was a pisser.
Yeah, it was. Damn it.
You're so funny. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it was.
You didn't have to think about it. I want to thank everybody for taking the time to listen to Crimes and Consequences. Again, if you haven't done so already, please hit the subscribe/follow button on whatever app you're listening to. I got all my information from the court records, by the way. So they're very helpful websites. I recommend everybody go to theinnocenceproject.org to learn more about wrongful convictions.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can go to our website to find out more and also about our other episodes, and that is at tntcrimes.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Hardcore True Crime. And if you're interested in becoming a member and getting ad-free, early releases, and additional
amazing episodes,
go to patreon.com/TNTcrimes, or you can find out more on our website.
And we want to take a second to thank all of our members, because their membership helps support us. Because these ads that you guys hear, they don't really pay that much. They don't. Anything else, Tanya?
Nope, that's it, Talia. Until our next episode.
Don't kill each other. Bye.